Currently, in Montreal, there are over 400 Pakistani refugees facing deportation in the coming days, weeks, and months. Since September 11th, these refugees from Pakistan have been systematically rejected at a rate of approximately 80% by Citizenship and Immigration Canada. Those Pakistani refugees facing deportation have formed the Action Committee of Pakistani Refugees, which is organizing a political campaign and collective action plan along with members of the No One Is Illegal campaign and the South Asian Women's Community Center to fight against Immigration Canada's efforts to deport Pakistani refugees. These refugees are facing deportation to both Pakistan and the United States, their port of entry into Canada. If deported to the U.S., many of the 400 Pakistani refugees would face the same persecution in the U.S. that many recently fled, detention and the mandatory INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, registration program for many Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians. If deported to Pakistan, these 400 refugees, mainly Shiite Muslim, would face the same religious persecution they fled in Pakistan. The grounds for rejection of these refugee claims from Citizenship and Immigration Canada being that the situation in Pakistan for these refugees has improved, despite many contrary human rights reports from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. I spoke with Shaim Naeem, a Pakistani refugee facing deportation, about the developing campaign against Immigration Canada, the political persecution these Shiite Muslim refugees faced in Pakistan, and the community's fears of being deported back to the United States.
They came together because over time they started to realize that it wasn't just individual cases, that everyone was being rejected, and the only thing they could do was to come together. And the basis of their rejection, again, being all of them were facing, was is that IRB was telling all of them that you all don't face persecution when you go back, you will have Pakistani state protection, and didn't acknowledge that they all came from the same sort of persecution from the SSP. So they realized that they had to come together, especially as a community, because it wasn't just individual cases, it was all of them, and for them to fight together because they were trying to individualize everyone, pinpoint things in everyone's case, but the underlying factor was that all of them were being rejected because they were told that they basically weren't refugees. You know, they didn't fit the conventional refugee definition. So they realized they had to come together and fight that. With regards to your first question about the relationship between the SSP and the Pakistani government and the police forces, obviously no one can establish any direct links, but it's pretty clear from everything that they faced, everything that everyone here has faced, is that the minority communities and the Shia community in particular don't have any police protection, any state protection. If anything, either the police is somewhat linked with them, the police is afraid of them as well. Just an aside, the case of Bilqis Fatima, we saw as well that when she filed an FIR with the police that her husband was murdered, they then turned around and put the case back on Bilqis. But she was saying that her and her partner came and they managed to get visas to the U.S., but they couldn't get them for the children, so they came and stayed in the U.S. for a while, and she left her children, her three children, with her. Her brother was, everyone pretty much knows that he was killed, but it was then covered up as a car accident, and there was no investigation was done on her brother's death, and her brother was taking care of her children, and then when he passed away, there was no one there to take care of her children, so they had to go back to Pakistan, try to arrange it for their children to come back. And they were in the States at this point. This was in July 2001. And then post 911, they faced a lot of harassment in the U.S. They increased criminalization, the fear of detention, profiling. Then they decided to come up to Canada from the States. She's saying that if they go back to the U.S., they will be put into detention right away, and then they'll face torture in the U.S. in the detention. All of the males over 16 will be profiled, fingerprinted, all of that that's going on in the U.S. night, and all the roundups, especially of Muslim and South Asian men. And then from there, they will be deported back to Pakistan anyway. So being deported to the U.S. ultimately does still mean being deported to Pakistan. So all it does is prolongs their anxiety, prolongs their suffering. And she's saying that as soon as they land back in Pakistan, as soon as they land at the airport, airport, the SSP, which is a wide organization and is very closely linked with the authorities in many ways, they'll know right away as soon as they land, and they will be murdered as soon as they land there. And they face, she's saying that their families back home, they can't go to mosques, their kids, a lot of times they don't send their kids to school because they're afraid their kids won't even return. And so they came to Canada hoping that they'd be able to live here, live in peace here. And for a while they were, until they started realizing after a couple of months that everyone was being rejected, and the levels of anxiety they face in Canada now is equivalent to the fear that they faced when they were in Pakistan, and it's no better at all than the lives they faced back in Pakistan.
और फिर वो लोग हमें पाकिस्तान भेज देंगे, हमें नहीं पता वो कितना अरसा हमें डिटेंशन में रखते हैं. यहां आ गई हूं और हमने अपील की. ये
She was saying that as soon as they came to the States, she was continuing with the fact of 911, and people were telling her that it was safe to come to Canada. But the only thing that they shouldn't declare is they shouldn't say that they were coming through the States, that they hadn't been at the border of the States because of the checkpoints that were set up in the U.S., not to tell people that they were coming through the States to Canada because of all the turnbacks that were happening right at the border. So she's saying that's the only thing that they didn't tell the border officials. But when she had her, when their family had the hearing with the IRB, the judge told them that, no, you don't face any persecution. It's safe for you to go back to Pakistan. And the judge thought that they had kind of schemed to come to Canada, that they didn't really face persecution, that it was a scheme for them to just come and live in Canada, and that they didn't really face any danger, especially since, you know, she went back to Pakistan, got her children. A lot of people are saying as well is that the burden is on them. They feel that they've said something wrong, as if though they shouldn't have gone back, as both of the women have just said that they, you know, they're being targeted themselves, as the burden of proof is on them, that they shouldn't have gone back, even though in these circumstances they have no options and they still face persecution, obviously. So a lot of what people are saying as well is that they feel like they have done something, that they've done something wrong, they should have said something differently, but in reality everyone's being told basically the same thing. And so they came to Canada, I think, because, you know, they were told that Canada is a better place to go than the U.S. and that they have freedom of religion, they won't be worried about their kids going to school and whatnot. And then they came here, their case was refused, and again the same point, that their lives are just as horrible here as it was, and they live in just as much fear and anxiety as they did back home.
I had the chance to speak with Rena Reza, a Pakistani refugee currently in Montreal, whose claim was rejected by Citizenship and Immigration Canada. She spoke about the situation she and her family fled in Pakistan and the illegitimacy of the grounds on which her refugee claim to Citizenship and Immigration Canada was denied.
First of all, I want to give an introduction that what we were doing in Pakistan. My name is Mrs. Kamal Raza, and as a profession, I am a teacher. I have been teaching in Pakistan, and my husband was a banker, and we were having a good life over there. We were well established. I was teaching in my Islamic center, and my husband was very active in his religious activities, and he was associated with the. And we have to face problems because of our religion in Pakistan. Because my husband was active and I was teaching in voluntary school, that's why the extremists, a group of extremists, that is Super Sahaba, they made our life miserable. If you know the situation in Pakistan, the extremist group is making the life of Shia peoples miserable. They attack their houses, they attack mosques, and even in our mosque where we go to do our religious practice, they fire on the people when they were praying. We have graves of those people in the mosque. So the people of Super Sahaba made our life miserable. They murdered my brother-in-law, and he was a police officer. When my husband went to the police station and he filed FIR against the people of Super Sahaba, that those people have murdered his brother-in-law, and people did not take any action over there. Still, they did not catch the culprits. And after that, they attacked our house, and my husband was injured, and he had to go to the hospital. And still, I have to face a very, very sad situation. And then again, they attacked my husband when he was going in the market. They fired at him, but he was lucky that he escaped and they could not catch him. And then we have to leave Pakistan. And so many times we got threats from them. Whenever I used to go to school, sometimes they give threats to me that they will kidnap me, they will kill us, they will kill our family. And when I was going to school, they hit me with a stick. And I told my husband, and they said that they will not leave our family. And when they attack my husband, we have to leave our country. We left our country on 22nd March 2001. We came to USA because we thought that it's easy to come over here. So we left our house. We have to leave our jobs. We were having good jobs. I have a 15-year experience of teaching, but I left my job only because of that, those people. My husband was a banker. He had a respectable job over there, but he left his job. We were confined in the house. We cannot live over there without jobs. So we decided to leave the country, and we left for America. And we left Pakistan, and you cannot believe that my parents are old, and there is nobody to take care of them. And we have to leave our old and sick parents. We have to leave our house, our jobs, everything. We left everything just to save our life, just for the protection of our life. And when we came to America, after 1 month, I heard that my father is suffering from cancer. And I had to go back. I was only there to take care of him. But when he left this world, I was not with him. I could not see my father with him. Now my mother is all alone over there. I wanted to see whether we could go back to Pakistan or not. But the situation in Pakistan was not favorable, so we decided to live over there. And then we decided to come to Canada because we heard that Canada is a Canadian government is so generous to the refugees. That's why we wanted to come to Canada. But I think they are not as generous as we heard, because our case has been refused. And the main objection they had given is that I went back to Pakistan. I only went there because my parents were sick. I heard my father is suffering from liver cancer. That's why I wanted to see him.
She had to go back to Pakistan since her father was sick and was suffering from liver cancer. And immigration, IRB then used that against her, that if in fact she was facing danger in Pakistan, why did she go back? And she went back and she was in hiding while she was there. She, you know, had to hide from the SSP while she was there, but she had to go back. And she was asking IRB to take that into consideration, that that's what she faced. She had to return back, that it was, she was asking them to take into account under, you know, humanitarian, compassionate grounds, that she had to go back, she had to return. Her father was sick. She's the only support for her family. She's the only daughter. Her and her family lived with her parents when they were in Pakistan, and when her father got sick, she had to return. She didn't have a choice, but she still faced danger. She obviously still faced that. And she did live in hiding, but she couldn't not go back since her father was sick. She didn't really have that option, but she still faced the danger. But she made the choice to go back and see him, and still lived in hiding. But immigration didn't take that into consideration. They kept forcing it upon her that she went back, therefore she wasn't facing danger, even though she kept saying she had to go back. She didn't have a choice, and she was in hiding while she was there. When that point was brought up, she was saying that she was in hiding, she was in hijab, she was covered, so that's why she was able to remain in hiding. And also the fact that Mr. Raza was the one who was on the hit list, and they acknowledged that he was the one who was facing more danger than she was, obviously, as a male. But even though they acknowledged that, they refused to acknowledge the fact that she could be in Pakistan in hiding since she was covered. And they brought that up and made that contradiction themselves. Even they said, like, okay, well, your husband's in more danger than you are. Yet when she went back and said, I was in hiding while I was there, they didn't take that point into consideration, even though earlier they had acknowledged it.
Currently, in Montreal, Bilqis Fatima, a 63-year-old wheelchair-bound Pakistani refugee, and her 17-year-old son, Imran Hussein, are being detained at Montreal's Laval Detention Center. They are considered a flight risk, Immigration Canada claims if released, they would go underground and not submit to their coming deportation orders. Bilqis Fatima is being held in detention despite her serious heart condition and diabetes. I spoke with Harsha Walia of the No One Is Illegal campaign about the case of Bilqis Fatima and Imran Hussein and the campaign to stop the deportation of Pakistani refugees.
Harsha Walia with the No One Is Legal campaign of Montreal. And right now we're working on supporting the Action Committee of Pakistani Refugees, and in particular one case of Bilqis Fatima, who's a 63-year-old Pakistani refugee. She's wheelchair-bound. She has a really critical medical condition. She's wheelchair-bound. She requires dialysis every 48 hours. She goes to the hospital from 6 p.m. to midnight every 48 hours. Her son, who's Imran Hussein, is 17 years old. He's a minor, and he's in detention as well with her. He needs to be with her. He's in detention, mandatory detention, but he's also required to take care of her. Bilqis and Imran have been in Canada for 3 years now, and their case was refused in March 2003. And the basis of their rejection is pretty much the same as all of the Pakistani refugees who have been refused, which is that they're told that they're not actually fleeing political persecution, that they have enough state protection from the Pakistani state back home, and that's pretty much across the board. So what we're targeting right now is the fact that IRB is not acknowledging that they are facing severe political persecution. But with regards to Bilqis in particular, she's in detention. She's considered a flight risk. She's a wheelchair-bound woman who is the last possible case of flight risk that IRB could have ever picked up. And there was a hearing for her on this past Thursday, which was July 31st. And in the hearing, before the hearing started, we were giving strong indications from IRB representatives that if, in fact, the community could take care of her, if there was a guarantee from someone in the community, then they would release her. But they never did. They kept telling her that she was a flight risk because she kept stating that, I don't want to be deported to Pakistan. I don't want to be deported. I want to stay in Canada. I'm a refugee. I can't go back to Pakistan. And then she was told, well, you're a flight risk because you refuse to be deported. Which is, of course, what CIC does. When someone refuses to be deported because they're facing extreme persecution and can't go back, they're deemed a flight risk and put into detention. So refugees face this catch-22 that we've seen across the board, and particularly with her, because she refuses to be deported. She's told that she's a flight risk. It's also crucial for her to get out. And it's also, for many of us, we couldn't understand, even from CIC's logic, why she wasn't released. Because, of course, if she dies in detention, then CIC will have a bigger scandal on their hands. So even from CIC logic, it made no sense to any of us. We thought she would be released. They can't deport her to Pakistan. The doctors in detention have informed CIC that if she's deported to Pakistan, she will die on the flight. She won't make the flight back. So CIC is trying to absolve themselves of all responsibility by deporting her back to the U.S. At present, the U.S. refuses to take her as well, because then they'll have her on their hands. And if anything happens to her while she's in mandatory detention in the U.S., then, of course, they'll have this on their hands. So the U.S. isn't accepting to take her because she's in critical condition. And CIC wants to release her from detention as fast as possible, but they can't just release her. They're refusing to release her and allow her to stay. Rather, they want to release her and have her deported as fast as possible. So it's a really critical, critical case. A lot of people have taken it up because her condition is serious. She's now gone blind in one eye. The medication she receives is inadequate. She's receiving expired medication. She doesn't know what she's receiving, if it's adequate or not, but her condition is deteriorating. She's unable to eat. And the demands of the campaign are that she be released immediately, her deportation be stopped, and that they be given adequate health care in Canada.
So in this situation with the Pakistani refugees, how does the relationship in terms of immigration between the United States and Canada play into the equation? When we're talking about Safe Third Country Agreement, a lot of the Pakistani refugees entered Canada through the United States. So in this case in particular, she would be facing deportation back to the United States. Could you expand on that a little bit? What would they face if returned to the United States?
All of them, again, yeah, they're they're in their demands. They're refusing to be deported to Pakistan and the U.S. explicitly because all of them face imminent deportation to the U.S. before they face deportation to Pakistan. And what that does for them is that it prolongs their suffering. It prolongs the fact that their anxiety, when as soon as they go back to the U.S., all of them will be fingerprinted. They will be detained. They will have mandatory detention in the U.S. That has pretty much been guaranteed for all of them, that they will be put in detention. Bilqis is already in detention in the U.S. Her son will then face more persecution. He will be fingerprinted, profiled. And the conditions in the U.S. detention centers are a lot worse in terms of solitary confinement, the number of hours that they're allowed to go out, and just the criminalization of Muslim men, Arab men, Muslim men, and South Asian men being a lot worse. So he's going to face that risk of being deported to the U.S. So one part of their case is also that they face persecution in Pakistan, but they doubly face persecution if they're then sent to the U.S., put in detention there. For those refugees who aren't already in detention, it's going to be 1,000 times worse for them if they're put in mandatory detention in the U.S., are profiled, and then basically after a couple of months will eventually be deported back to Pakistan anyway. So the one thing that IRB has used is against them as well is that when they say that they say they don't want to be deported to Pakistan, they say they don't want to be deported to the U.S., they want to stay in Canada, but when the IRB says that you're going to be deported to the U.S., then of course, they say, well, then we may as well be deported to Pakistan. What's the point of deporting us to the U.S. where we'll be in detention for 3 months, face disgusting situations, be criminalized, as many communities of color are presently being criminalized, and then eventually to be deported back to Pakistan anyway. So when they say things like that, then IRB, gets on them and says, oh, so you don't really face persecution in Pakistan. So it's they're facing an incredible catch-22 because for all of them, they will face deportation no matter what. And when they say, why are you prolonging our suffering? Why are you sending us to the U.S. when we'll be sent to Pakistan anyway? You may as well, if you're going to get rid of us, you may as well do it fast. Then it's used against them.
Can you speak a little bit more generally about the Action Committee of Non-Status Pakistanis who are facing deportation in Canada? How are they organizing the demands of the campaign, some of the activities that they've put together?
They've been incredible in self-organizing. It's been about a year now that people have been receiving deportation orders. In the past 2 weeks, 10 people have already been deported. The last deportation was on July 30th, a family who was deported back to Pakistan on July 30th. And they've been doing this for about a year where they've been trying to do it. They initially started off trying to do casework, and when they realized that everyone was being refused, over 80% of the cases have been refused, particularly post 9/11. Their demands are that, again, the deportations have to be stopped to Pakistan and the U.S. and that all people need to be given status. And again, the main point there being is that IRB is rejecting people across the board because they're being told that they don't face persecution. And of course, they all do. All of them have stories where they've been persecuted. Family members have been killed, tortured, raped, kidnapped. So that explicitly has to be targeted because IRB has these reports and they have to be held accountable to the reports that immigration themselves produce. And of course, then the ties into the fact that Pakistan and Canada and the U.S. are negotiating trade agreements. Pakistan received a huge debt relief post 9/11, and the same thing that we saw with the non-status Algerians, that for the fact that Pakistan has to prove that it's a stable country for investment, a stable country for trade, a stable ally in the war against terrorism, it has to then prove that by saying that we've taken care of these groups, we've taken care of, there's officially a ban on the SSP, but as we heard before, there was a...
Can you explain the SSP?
The SSP is a very militant Sunni organization. They're one of their sort of wings is the Lakshvi Jhangvi, which is equivalent to the VHP and the RSS that we have in India. And they're very militant. Their platform is basically that it's legitimate to kill all Shias. It's legitimate to do that. If you do that, then, God will bless you, Allah will bless you. And it's also important to note that all of this Islamicization in Pakistan, this very militant Islamicization in the government, was a lot of it happened in the 70s and 80s with the help of the U.S., with the U.S. propping up these governments, allowing for certain Islamic forces to take place, to not allow any sort of dissent in Pakistan against foreign policies of the U.S. that were going on in Pakistan at the time, especially during the Iran-Iraq war and then after that with the war in Afghanistan. So a lot of that has a lot to do with the foreign policies that have gone on for at least 3 decades in the U.S. and in Canada. So that's the SSP. They're a nationwide their nationwide organization. A lot of the refugees are told, well, if you face persecution, why don't you move to another city? And of course, the SSP is nationwide. Their hit lists are very centralized. As soon as they land at the airport, police forces, security forces, who are very much in collusion with the SSP, who want these minority communities, who want people who are political dissenters. And of course, not all of them are Shia, right? There's a lot of refugees who are political dissent, who face gender persecution. They'll be picked up at the airport right away and will be killed and tortured and raped.
Can you explain why you, as a member of the No One Is Legal campaign, is involved in this? And maybe explain a little bit about the No One Is Legal campaign.
Well, as a No One Is Legal member, it's incredibly important for us to be involved because we see the links that are, you know, when we talk about globalization, we talk about imperialism, we talk about colonization, realizing that these forces are ongoing, and the situations in communities in the South are created very much from our histories of colonization that we faced, our histories of divide and conquer, and the histories of, you know, what's now called religious extremism in South Asia and the Arab world have very much been created by forces here, forces that try to foster certain religious groups, try to make countries stable for trade and investment, prop up certain groups. So for No One Is Legal, if we look at it from that perspective, when we talk about globalization and the forces that create the conditions for migration, and especially, you know, settler states in North America, Australia, New Zealand, to acknowledge that those forces are created by those of us who live here, by those governments and those corporations that are in fact here. And in that, as you know, as we've said lots of times before, that these governments are very keen on making, you know, creating stable situations, for example, in Pakistan, opening the borders to trade, for allowing, there's now a free trade zone that's being considered in South Asia with India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. While, of course, then that means that refugees are increasingly displaced and they need to be deported back because you have to prove that these countries are safe for return. So as a No One Is Legal vision, we have to say that we can't tolerate criminalization of these communities. We can't tolerate criminalization of refugees. There are over 10 million refugees in the world right now, and we have to acknowledge that those forces that have created them have been going on for decades and have been going on for over a century now, and that people have to take responsibility, especially in the North, for the conditions that they have created.
Bilqis Fatima, along with many of the other Pakistani refugees, are facing deportation to the United States. However, U.S. authorities and the Immigration and Naturalization Service of the U.S. have not agreed to allow them to enter the country. Essentially, they are now in a position of stateless limbo. If deported back to Pakistan, they face potential death and ongoing religious persecution. To get more information about the campaign to stop the deportation of Pakistani refugees in Montreal, contact No One Is Illegal at 514-859-9022 or noone is illegal@tao.ca. This report has been produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christophe. ਜਿਹੜੇ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਐਵੇਂ ਹੀ ਵਕਤ ਗਵਾਇਆ ਸਾਡਕ ਯਾਰ।